You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. This is the Comedian's Comedian podcast. And today I'm very, very pleased and proud to be speaking to Martin Urbano. Martin took the Edinburgh Festival by storm last year, and he was nominated for his debut show, Apology Comeback Tour, in which he adopts the position of a comedian who has been cancelled and is coming back on the tour to give a sort of mealy-mouthed, sorry, not sorry type apology. It's an incredibly smart piece of work. He's a really funny and engaging and very, very clever comic. It was one of my favourite shows there last year and a sort of an instant invite onto the show. Very pleased we could get this interview recorded. He has one of my favourite. It's arguably the most vigilante-like origin stories in comedy. We're going to find out more about that, as well as some of the more usual stuff you might expect, such as the difference between creating material for UK and US audiences, but with a particularly Urbano twist on that question. And we'll find out in this section as well all about his experience working with Stamptown, who are one of those young, cool, young people's organisations for making comedy, who are going to be running the world 20 years from now. And I was thrilled to perform with them at South by Southwest, but felt like a creaking old man because they're all so bloody clever and funny. Martin is no exception. This entire episode you can watch. You can watch it if you join the Insiders Club at patreon.com/comcompod and support the podcast with a small monthly regular donation. You will also get access to 20 minutes of extras, including Martin's feelings, the temptation of quitting stand-up, and also we talk at length about his writing job and finding his place within the Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon team, or not. That's all in the extras. Now let's get to this episode with Martin Urbano. Welcome to the show, Martin.
Great, hey, Stuart. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. This is a stagey introduction. Hi. Which I think is... That's quite... We should almost redo that and make it more stagey, because a fundamental concept in your comedy is the sort of reality-unreality of what you're doing.
Yes, thank you for saying that.
I tell you, on the way here, I suddenly thought, oh, wow, I wonder if... I'd forgotten that you'd heard this podcast and I hadn't explained to you what it was. And I suddenly thought, oh, God, what if he comes in character? But then... tell me about what in character would... mean? Do you think about it as being in character?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it's different because I use my own name, you know,
so
it's
more and just your own voice
and my own voice. And I'm not doing I don't have an eye patch on or whatever. Yeah. But I don't know. I it's too hard to do what I'm doing like sustainable for like 1 hour. You know, like I can't just be riffing in that character for 1 hour and not get in actual trouble.
Yes.
And say, you know, I want to say stuff that I stand behind, so I need to think about it.
Yes, I see what you mean.
I can a little bit here and there, but, you know, sprinkle some stuff in, but nothing like to come in and be like, yeah, I'm this guy.
We should explain to the listener who may not be aware of what you do, Would you mind explaining? It's the worst thing you can say to a comic is, hey, tell us what kind of comic you are. But what you're doing here at the Soho Theatre and what you did at Edinburgh to great critical acclaim, and I love the show, as you know, it's something very specific. It's not just a stand-up show. So can you just break it down for us so we've got the territory?
I am, my show's called The Apology Comeback Show, and it's, the conceit is that I have done something in my past, and this is my first special back. Yeah.
And it was your debut show at the festival.
And which is, in reality, it's my first big hour, and yeah, my sort of debut to the world.
It's such a sweet conceit. Tell me about when you first came up with that. Well, I was wondering whether that was your kind of concept for a show, but it seems from the kind of research I've done, I've sort of seen bits of you doing comedy amateur class on Chris Gethard's show.
Oh, sure.
And your Jimmy Kimmel set, which I guess is like 6 years ago now, something like that.
Yeah, about.
So you clearly have been building this being the thing that you do for a while. So does that mean that the apology comeback show premise is a natural point along that journey?
Yeah, it is actually. I mean, I was always making fun of comedy. Is like how I started making fun of what I consider to be quote unquote bad comedy, which at one point I thought was like, you know, like Starbucks cup sizes, you know, everybody saying the same premise over and over, and then me taking my dark twist on it.
Yeah.
And then eventually my definition of what bad stand up changed. You know, it's like it became like, oh, all these guys, especially after the Me Too movement, all these guys talking about like, can't say anything anymore. You can't say, I'm scared to even be around a woman. You know, what if I sneeze around a woman? And I was like, oh, this is so bad. I've heard this a million times. Let me just make fun of that. And then when I did that, something struck a chord and I was like, ooh, this is interesting. And I just started fleshing that out more and more.
Do you mean struck a chord with audiences or with yourself and your satisfaction about what you were doing?
Probably both, but maybe even more myself. You know, like, I don't know. I think the audience would have liked whatever I tried to do and really went for, but I really thought something was interesting. Nobody else was doing it. Here's what happened. I did a taping for a Comedy Central thing, the Comedy Central digital taping on September 11th, 2017, I think. And then it didn't come out until February 2018. And in those 5 months, the material was a couple of jokes about the Me Too movement in this character, very early draft of what I'm doing now. And I thought, in those 5 months, surely everybody's going to make fun of these dudes, these bros, like these guys suck. Everybody's going to come at this, is going to age like milk. And then when it came out, nobody else had done any jokes from that perspective at all, except one other comedian, Sam Morril, had like a Me Too joke that wasn't like, I'm scared, you know, like an actual one.
It was satirizing the bro freak out.
Exactly. Yeah. It was like an actual funny take and a perspective that wasn't just like, oh, I'm scared. And I was like, oh, maybe I'm onto something if nobody else is traversing this right now.
Yes. And do you remember a specific joke where you felt like things slotted into place?
And this one is in my show. I'm trying to remember now. Me Too, the Me Too movement is important, but I think we should be careful about just immediately believing every woman coming forward with an allegation about me personally. And that's sort of like the first one that was like, oh, that's fine.
Oh, that's the thing. So then So that is kind of it's a hop, skip, and a jump into this idea that you specifically, the comedian Martin Obama, under your own name, have not exactly a terrible secret, but have, you know, you are continually, if not even insinuating, just outright stating specific allegations have been made against you.
That is
such, I mean, like even describing it now, it's such dangerous territory for, you know, to put online in a world in which we know people miss jokes, misunderstand jokes, get the wrong end of the stick. It wouldn't be impossible for an idiot, but there's loads of them out there, to watch your set and go, this guy really is, you know, or the way in your set you brand yourself as the pedophile comedian. I mean,
I don't brand myself as that.
What a risk.
I get branded that, but
But you tell us you've been branded what I mean? So talk to me about the, obviously that edge, that frisson is like, well, there's some comedy juice in there.
Mm-hmm.
But tell me just a bit more before we get to that about this, the chord that it struck within you. Like, what's your, what's the depth of your personal beef with the cancelled comedian, the inverted commas?
Oh, interesting. Okay, yeah, we're going to get into it. Well, I mean, I like am a big comedy fan. I started as a comedy nerd, hard comedy nerd. And I felt like when I was growing up, I learned a lot from comedians. Like I would talk to my parents about like things, and they'd be like, "How do you know that?" I'm like, "I watched somebody do stand up about it." You know, kid learning about the world through stand up.
You learn how the world works. Yeah, right.
And so I felt like a little, you know, betrayed and upset, as I'm sure many people did, when certain people have been revealed to be less than good. A polite way to say it, I suppose. And I just got upset about that. I got angry. I'm like, why? Oh, I reanalyzed a lot of stuff that I just took as like gospel, because I'm a comedy nerd that you can never criticize another comedian. And I looked at it and I'm like, oh, there were some things here that I think have been poisonous to my mind to other people's minds. I got upset that like I was a kid hanging around comedy scenes, and like if I was like a woman, if a young woman hanging around, it would have been a very different experience for me. I think that
sucks. Yeah, right.
So I just got personally upset about that, and then just the making the pedophile joke with the people coming out with allegations just kind of crashed into my own sense of morality and just became whatever this show is.
Great. That's such an interesting sort of an insight, not only into the work you do, but also, of course, I don't think we've ever come across that subject on this podcast, the notion of recognizing that your comedy nerd hanging out at gigs, your experience was safe because you're a guy.
Yeah. I mean, like, I started in high school. Like, I was 16 when I did, like, my first open mic. And my dad went with me. He was like, I'm going to go with you to this gig. I was, like, so embarrassed. I was like, Dad, no, come on. I want to hang out with the comedians. And now looking back, I'm like, thank God he went with me.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's good. That's – I'm glad he did. It was a little overprotective, but it's, you know, for a kid going into those spaces and knowing who exists in there, especially in the open mic circuit level, it's like, ugh. Every, like, young female comedian I talked to is like – had talked to would be like, yeah, everybody wants to, all these older guys want to write with me. I'm like, why don't they ever want to write with me?
Yeah, right. The worst you're going to get is like, probably someone, like the worst you're going to get is a brush off, hey, fuck off, kid, you're not good enough.
Sure.
As opposed to, yeah, want to write with me. And I remember that from you know, when I was an open mic comic, you know, between 15 and 20 years ago, just kind of recognizing that phenomenon of like, an attractive female act 2 years in is now going out with a guy in his 40s.
Sure.
Curious. Sure. You know, cool, I guess. I don't know anything about, I'm sure that happened in many above board ways.
Sure.
But also there was a certain set of things you and I didn't need to think about.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And then the sense of feeling, I'm really curious about that sense of betrayal. Like that's a really good point. I'm kind of interrogating myself now. Did I feel betrayed when I realized comedians were scum? No, I think I felt more like, more fool me. You know, the thought that I've had in the past is like, I got into this for the siblingness, the non-gendered fraternity of it, you know.
Totally, sure.
I got into it for the community. And I remember I went through this with street performing before comedy, where I was like, we're all the good people. The good men and women and non-binary people, we're all on the right side because we all know the secret and we're all in the gang.
Totally.
And then you're like, oh, some of us are awful.
Exactly.
Some of us are boring. Some of us are short-sighted. I'm quite naturally cringe, has been pointed out to me. You know, but we're not all necessarily good guys just because we're on the heist together.
Absolutely. I used to think everybody was joking all the time. I used to think just everybody's joking. Everybody, every single person. And then I realized that, I don't know, some people like mean just what they're saying. Like, just because I'm making this dark joke and I'm like, I know what I'm doing. We're all being ironic over here. And then that person says something actually sexist or actually racist. And I'm like, no, they're just joking. And then over time, you just learn like, no, that's just how they feel.
Yeah.
And that's like, oh.
Did you ever feel as a younger comic, were you ever in danger of becoming, for want of a better word, one of the incel comics? Do you know what I mean? One of the like as an impressionable 16-year-old learning the way, as you say, I mean, that's exactly what I did, learning the way the world works through stand-up comedy routines, going, that's what to expect from parenthood, that's what to expect, that's how to behave, that's the things to notice in a situation where you go to the doctor for a particular type of exam or whatever.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, that path has been, I know more about that from comedy routines than I do my friends, certainly as a guy,
totally.
You know, socialized to, oh no, we all have to go through this on our own without ever asking for help. And I'm supposed to know how to deal with this. And get that information from comedy,
which
I guess in a way is why, you know, the arguably disgraced comedian, let's call them the supposedly cancelled comedians.
There we go.
That's why they have so many defenders, because they are the father figures of so many of their fans.
Totally. Yeah.
There's not, that wasn't a question.
I agree.
Turn that into a question and answer it, please, Martin.
You asked if I like felt in any danger of becoming that.
That was a question.
But I think in some ways, like, it did poison my mind. Like, it did like kind of just make me think about stuff in a different way. But I've been lucky enough to have certain people in my life who have kind of I trust immensely, especially who have a step outside of comedy or just whose perspective I trust. Mm. And I trust myself enough that I don't think I was ever in any real danger of getting, you know, I see some of the current people, the current state of incels and, you know, like a male, you know, Andrew Tate's and, you know, mm-hmm. fans and Jordan Peterson fans. And stuff. And it's like, I don't think I was ever in that, you know, yeah.
Thank
danger.
Christ, Andrew Tate isn't funny. Yeah. Can you imagine it?
No, he's funny.
Is he funny? My knowledge of Andrew Tate begins and ends sort of with that sentence. I'm pleased not to know too much about it. You could have. I appreciate now you're being ironic, but but if he had more charisma than I imagine he has, what sure. a dangerous fucking situation to be in.
Exactly.
Yeah. More on that. The depth of your beef. We were talking about the depth of your beef. Oh. So part of it is a sense of. Feeling betrayed by the father figures. I mean, I'm saying the word father. It's not, you're putting words in your mouth there. But those, the people who were informing your perspective of the world.
Yes.
And you suddenly find out in more than one instance are coming from a place that actually if you, you were imagining more irony to what they were saying.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And turns out they're kind of just like bullies. And I didn't really know. And it seems I aligned myself with, you know, thoughts that people who have been dicks have. Mm. You know, I don't like to be on that side of things.
What's your radar like for spotting that kind of behavior now amongst your peers? Now that you're in comedy clubs and green rooms on a professional basis, do you still see that kind of behavior? Do you notice it differently?
I think I'm not in the spaces that I don't feel super comfortable in. Yeah. Typically, I think just like I don't get really asked and I don't put myself out there. So I'm sure I see it. And I see it. And I really like to have camaraderie with the people who also see it, which is that's always a fun one to kind of like walk aside and talk to the cool young hip people and be like, that was a weird thing that guy said. Right. So that's like fun. But I'm not really in those spaces too much. And when I am, I'm kind of just like keep to myself. I don't know. It's also like. It's weird to go on this journey and then kind of feel like you were, you know, it's like after the Me Too movement, after these guys like were gone, it's like, okay, things are changing. And then things kind of reverted back. And so it's like, was I wrong about that stuff? Maybe everything's fine. Am I insane? Like, what do I think? What do I believe? What do I feel is actually right? So it's just kind of been like this like push and pull of like finding where – you know, can I work with – some people are like, yeah, you just work with those people and, you know, you don't have to like them, but that's your job. You go, you show up, and you do that. I'm like, I guess that is a perspective to, you know, they're going to be around. And if you hear things about certain people, like, what does that mean? Like, it's not my story to tell, mm-hmm. but it's – is it my story to clock? How much is clocking it versus
Do you take yourself off bills with people when you find out who's on them? Yeah, right.
Exactly. So I was like, navigating all that has been tricky and interesting, but – typically, I just hang out with, you know, fellow weirdos, sensitive weirdos. But
so you're given the I just want to stay with the show that you're doing at Soho. How's it been going? How is it being received at Soho?
It's been good. Yeah, yeah. Soho Theater is cool. It's fun. It's fun to do a show for an audience that is paying attention completely.
So Edinburgh, you were doing that show for audiences who didn't get it, right?
I had quite a few of those, yeah. Show that you watched, did you see anybody, could you spot anybody in the audience who was hating it?
There were quiet patches here or there, mm-hmm. but I felt like, I think I maybe saw you on like a Tuesday night, mm-hmm. so there was a bit, I felt like it was a bit more of informed.
Gotcha.
Like, if people were uncertain, they were just uncertain.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone was like, thigh slapping at some of the awful things with no concept of that, which presumably has happened.
Yeah, a comedian friend of mine, she went with her father to one of the shows and was like, yeah, he was just laughing like normal, like sincerely. He's like, yeah, I believe everything he's saying. She's like, no, he's joking. He's like, what?
But you are so deft. You're so subtle. It's really interesting. Yeah. One of the first things you said was, I'm doing jokes about comedy. And before you arrived, I was describing you, an aspect of you, to Andrew, who was teching for us kindly. And I said, he kind of almost reminds me of the Simpsons idea of a stand-up comic. Like, white guys drive like this, black guys drive like this, which is a comedy, or, you know, a comedy writer making fun of comedy.
Right.
But you're so, and I've seen this in it's not an original thought of mine, but in a couple of reviews, they quite accurately point out that part of the fun is you were just when we're expecting you to wink at us, instead you double down, which I think is so it's so sweet to watch. It's great. But presumably that then comes with risks, not only in the show as it is now, but in the whole of your oeuvre. You know, you must always be like, I mean, Jesus, tell me about developing the bit of material where you refer to yourself as having been branded as the paedophile comedian. Because it's fucking so funny. That Kimmel set, which I don't want to spoil for anyone that hasn't seen it, but it's on YouTube. You can see this Jimmy Kimmel set. Just tell me about that and what it kind of, like, what's at stake for you when you're developing it. Like, obviously, it's fixed, it's finished. You do it, and if they don't understand it, that's their fault.
Yeah.
Was it written perfectly to achieve that from the jump?
In the show or the Kimmel set?
The Kimmel. Let's go back to the Kimmel set. Let's do it chronologically. Yeah. But like, was that stuff by the time you're getting to that Mad Libs bit?
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk about what the bit is? So by the time you get to the Mad Libs bit, which isn't a thing we have over here, but I can kind of retroactively understand what Mad Libs are.
Interesting.
It's almost like an improv game. You're asking for a couple of words from the audience and then putting them into a pre-existing.
No one has told me that.
No, we don't.
Mad Libs don't exist over here.
No, because the bit works. I understand the bit, and I just go, "Oh, that must be an American thing." I think I still understood enough at the right time to understand the joke.
Gotcha. Yeah. Which is because it has not. It felt like a dip in the show when I do the Mad Libs thing. But that is interesting.
Great. Oh, well, I hope I haven't rocked you for tonight.
No. I have no other choice than to do it. It's sort of the crux of how I get into a 10-minute chunk on pedophiles. But yeah.
But like, so the premise of that bit is a person, or the premise of the reveal is a person who is legally mandated to read a specific statement about allegations about, you know, their conviction for paedophilia is trying to smuggle it into an improv game.
So
then the reveal of, oh, Jesus, that's what he's doing. Fuck me, what a bit, man.
Thanks, man. Yeah.
So I suppose my question was, did that bit arrive fully formed in such a way that it always worked? Or did you have the idea and take a few different shots at how to make it work? Because that's some dicey territory going, I really hope it works. Otherwise, I'm just literally, you know what I mean? If it might get taken at face value or whatever, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, it was also, you know, one of my first, like, big bits. So it was, like, exciting. The original version was, and I adapted it into pieces of it show up later in the show, but I had jokes about Obama.
Okay.
So it was like, no one had, you know, no one's making jokes about Barack Obama, who's like, you know, me, a young hip kid. So I had them say adjectives and I would put it in, and then I would do mean jokes about Barack Obama and then just put in their thing. And that worked like all right. People like, it was like, oh, we like that. It's like Mad Libs or something. And I was like, okay, there's something here. I don't remember what clicked, why I wanted to call myself a registered sex offender. I just think that was like playing with the idea of, they can say something to me, and it doesn't matter because I have something that I'm going to say.
Yeah.
So I'll just plug in whatever they say. It feels like they're part of the show, but really they're not in any way. So that was just a conceit, and somehow I ended up a registered sex offender, and then it killed, and it worked. That was like my closer for a while.
Did a part of you have to go, oh, God, that killed. I have to keep doing this. I have to keep... No.
You know, when you're a young comic, you're just like so excited that something works well.
Of course.
I didn't even think about the repercussions or potential... bad things that
I mean, have there been
it.
Any? Is this just me being skittish? Have there been any repercussions? I imagine if you search the phrase paedophile comedian, like your name or face may come up.
I wonder, probably not.
I wonder.
I think after all these reviews from Edinburgh, it might be me. I don't know. I just did not have any fear at the time. And when people would ask if I was actually a registered sex offender, I just thought it was funny.
Yeah, okay.
Which is, I mean, what I talk about in the show.
Sure, of course.
But it like happened slowly over time. And then I was like, I felt so proud of that bit also. And so I took a bunch of meetings after that set came out. Like, it was like right after I did Just for Last New Faces. So it was like things were kind of like cooking for me. And in the in those meetings, people would talk about like, oh, we really like that bit about how no one can tell what race you are. And I was like, yeah, that was like one of the bits I did. But isn't it crazy? I call myself a pedophile on ABC. Like, isn't that awesome? And they're like, oh, the Mad Libs thing. Yeah, that was funny, Mad Libs. But anyway, the race stuff. Like, we care about this. Like, we want to do a show about how no one can tell what race you are. I'm like, what show is that? What is that? What is this? What are you talking about? So I got a little frustrated. I was like, look how I got away with something so cool. Let me just keep doing that. Let me keep showing everybody how much I can get away with. And then it just sort of like started snowballing from there.
And so what do you anticipate was their reaction? Is it that they preferred that material, the race stuff, or is it that they were as skittish as I clearly am about the, like, who wants to put money into a project? Oh, this comedian, he likes to pretend he's a registered sex offender. Yeah, yeah. Like, if you're a producer, is that going to be hard to get away to your commissioning editor? You know?
Of course, yeah, there's nothing they could have done with that. But race, especially at that time, was kind of like a thing that they could maneuver into a show.
Sure.
They felt.
Okay.
Which I felt, no. I'm like, what? You can't tell what race I am? How is that a show? Like that. Yeah. I literally got pitched that one time. Like, this doesn't make any sense at all. But of course, yeah, there's nothing they can do with that Mad Libs bit as far as like developing any sort of idea at all.
Have you ever, with the satirical aspect of what you're doing, which is a huge part of what you're doing, have you ever needed to or felt an urge to, has there ever been a situation where you've wanted to kind of go, you get this isn't real, right?
Yeah.
I mean, have you ever wanted to break
character
like that?
Of course. Yeah. I see people in Edinburgh. I would see even at that point, people in the audience who hated me. And I'm like, I think we're on the same exact side of things. And that makes me sad. You know, like that bums me out to just see like it happened every so often. Just
people who
a young woman in the crowd staring daggers at me.
Yeah.
Just miserable to be there. Surprised nobody walked out. Like, I don't know why I never got a single walkout, but they would just hated me, and they're just sitting there hating me. And then there was this one woman who, like, towards the end, like, maybe, like, the last week of the run, like, at this point, getting good reviews, positive word of mouth, but and the show was packed out, and she was just staring at me. And then at the Mad Libs bit, when I asked for an adjective from the crowd, it was a beat where nobody said anything, and then she said, angry. And I said, well, okay, I'm not going to read into that. And then I just wrote it down. And then kind of like poked a little fun, like later on where I say, you know, I'm trying to better my set for next time for you all in the long run for next time you see it. And I pointed her next time you see it, you know, just like kind of like being a little, you know, tongue in cheek about it. And then at the end of the show, I'm like standing outside talking to people. And she comes up to me and she goes to shake my hand. I'm like, huh? And then she like kind of like does the handshake cut off and says, hey, it's okay. I was just on my period. And then rolls her eyes and walks away.
Oh.
And I felt bad about that for a while. I mean, I felt, you know, she was on her period. Like, that's
But yeah, like, I mean, that's like collateral damage, isn't it? Someone who is probably completely politically on the same wavelength as you, you know, but they're walking away having had a bad experience.
Yes.
Which you're not in control of because there isn't a way that you can do the show. Like, could you have stopped and just, like, when you realized she hated it, could you... Like, how much would it kind of destroy, how much would the show crumble if you just went, this is a character, by the way, and then got on with it? Is that an option at any point?
It's like if you're watching a play.
But they do that. If someone's phone goes off, sometimes an actor will go,
oh,
turn your fucking phone off and then get back into character.
Oh,
then,
interesting. Yeah. Oh, maybe I should do that then. No, but I don't know.
I feel
like,
bad for that lady. Yeah. I feel bad for you. Bad for her.
I remember hearing about that show Little House on the Prairie. Are you familiar with this one?
I'm very vaguely,
I'm very vaguely familiar with it, too. But it was, like, a very old show. I don't remember, 60s or something. And there was, like, one little, like, neighbor girl who was really mean to our main girl we liked.
Okay.
And she got so much hate mail from people just being like, you're a piece of shit. It's, like, to this little girl. And I was like, oh, interesting. People just, like... see something and they're angry, but they can't in the show then go like break and be like, hey, I'm just joking around. Okay, now back to the show. You know, like it doesn't make
sense. Could you not write something that leans a little harder into that specific event? Have you ever tried? I'm not suggesting.
Do you feel like my show doesn't have hints?
What I feel it does have hints. I simply like, and I mean this as a compliment. You play it so subtly. Do you know what I mean? Maybe, I don't know, is there a difference between, I hate asking this question, is there a difference between UK and US audiences in how the stuff is received? Is that woman an example? Like, can we be particularly boneheaded or does stuff like that happen?
It happens in the States too.
It happens in the States. Yeah. So there must be some people whom you're leaving behind.
At the beginning, yes. At the beginning, my Women's March jokes, I don't know if you remember those.
Yeah.
I would do those when I was opening
up. Is that like
up.
All kinds of, every kind of woman was there, 1 through 10. Yeah, I mean.
Exactly.
Like, I think the problem is, probably people like that woman have been subjected to actually misogynist comics like that. They've heard that joke.
Exactly.
That's the basis. Yeah.
Exactly. So, I mean, I have so many thoughts about this like phenomenon specifically, but when I was first doing those Women's March jokes, I was developing them while I was opening up for Chris Gethard.
Yeah.
So Chris Gethard's audience, me going in cold.
Yeah.
And then doing those Women's March jokes. Silence. Oh, I did shows where those jokes got absolute silence. Luckily, I thought there was still something there. I just had to like retweak it. I mean, like that pedophile chunk, I can only do in my own hour show. I cannot work that out in spots, you know. The Me Too stuff, kind of a little bit, you know, I can kind of like gain some leeway for like 8 minutes and then try 2 minutes of it or something, you know, when I'm doing showcases around the city. But like that one, it's like I have to be headlining to work out that 10-minute pedophile chunk. Anyway, so working out the Women's March jokes has just been like it's like I'm sharpening and sharpening to get that number of people who hate it for the right reasons down.
Yes, of course. But yes, I understand what you mean. People who hate it for the right reasons. People who aren't aware that you are very specifically satiring or pastiching exactly that thing that they hate.
Exactly.
But there is, like, in order for you to do that, and I'm sure there are huge numbers of audiences who see your show and are immensely satisfied that you are taking this risk and taking these targets specifically.
Yes. Cathartic. When people say cathartic, I'm like, that's exactly what I want.
Yes.
Good.
They feel just as betrayed as you.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, I think even the Brian Logan, who is the comedy critic for The Guardian, I don't know if you know your relationship to reviews.
I saw that review.
That's fascinating because it's almost like he... What's the point he made? He said something along the lines of, I can't quote it.
I can quote it. Let me pull that up real quick here. Let me just pull up. He said, good luck disentangling whether, finally, we're laughing at misogyny and child abuse or at a desperate comic who thinks they're clever.
But he gave it a decent... I mean, he does...
Three out of five stars.
Yeah, 3 out of 5. That's good for him. You know, like, it's almost like he couldn't... I feel like in that review he didn't want, and again I don't know the specific wording other than that sentence you said, it felt like he didn't want to put his money where his mouth is. It's almost like he suspected it was a satire but didn't want to say this is a satire in case he was wrong.
Interesting.
Or something. I don't know him personally well, you know.
Yeah.
But I thought that was really interesting because elements of that I felt like he did get it.
Yeah.
Perhaps his point was, are you less clever than you think you are? And actually, you are getting... It's like when people are ironically racist. If you're ironically racist enough, you're racist, you know?
Totally.
So maybe he was going, this guy is painting with the ideas of misogyny in order to mock them. But along the way, we also laugh at things, you know?
Sure, which is a fair point. And, you know, that's something I always try to wrestle with where people say, like, ironic misogyny is misogyny. Sure. I've seen that, and I've talked with, and I've reached out to friends who have like tweeted stuff like that, been like, "Hey, do you think my shit's like just like?" And they're like, "No, you're doing good."
Yeah.
I say that not to pat myself on the back, but just to be like, I'm trying to check my work as much as I can. I try to get the feedback and work it out. And I will say, I don't know, something clicked or something, but in the past few days, the women in the audience, and I saw a review that just came out from the Telegraph that spotted this as well, that the women in the audience were the ones laughing the most.
Yeah.
And then I noticed that there were a couple dudes in the crowd really not liking it.
Great.
And I'm like, I think I've gotten to the good point. I think I've gotten it where I want it to be.
Because they are getting, they are receiving exactly what you're putting out.
Yeah.
And the guys, the dudes in the audience are pissed off because you're taking down the shit they like.
Yes. And I hope I hope that this trend continues, but I've noticed in the past couple of days, like in Edinburgh, I did Monkey Barrel.
Yes.
And the guys were, of the two guys on Dates with Two Girls, the dudes walked out first.
Okay.
And then the girls followed.
Okay.
The dudes were not laughing the whole time. The girls were laughing sometimes, but they were like, yeah, we'll leave too. But the guys walked out first.
Great.
Apparently they were footballers.
Okay.
Famous footballers.
I wouldn't know. I would know even less than you about that.
Yeah. So it's like, okay, like bro-y guys did not like what I was putting down. Mm. Like that's positive, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
What's next in terms of the character of Martin Urbano when you're writing your next show?
Mm-hmm.
Are you like what is next? Like, you know, are you going to continue plowing this furrow because you do it so well, or has this show said what you wanted to say and now you want to broaden it? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
This has said what I wanted to say, and I am sick of it. Also, I don't want to. I don't like the feeling of how the amount of work it took to get to this point.
Yeah.
Made me feel bad a lot. It's like, you know, yes. I'm not, you know, selling out crazy big rooms and stuff. I'm like, I'm doing okay for myself. I'm sure. proud of myself, but it's not like a. So I'm traveling around, performing to sometimes like half full rooms, mm-hmm. and doing this stuff, and then just I show up to a city, upset some people in the audience who I think, like, we would get along in real life. And I'm like, what am I doing? Like, I'm not building up a better – being the pedophile comedian isn't, as I say, isn't like a very profitable, lucrative thing. It's like, I think I want to put this out there, and I'm curious about what comes out next. I don't know.
Yes.
Maybe I won't be able to put it down, because, like, every time I think of a new pedophile joke, I'm like, that's pretty impressive. Wow. Yeah. How did I come up with a new one? That's crazy. So we'll see. I don't know. I am curious.
Can you keep it going long enough? Can you make a career enough out of it that in 20 years, society has flipped back around the other way? Suddenly you become acceptable for all the wrong reasons.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's double uncancelled. Great.
Pedophilia is a mental illness.
Yeah. I mean. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's yeah.
I'm trying to also, like, add teases of that, like, into the show. Just like, I mean, I've done, like, so much research into all of this. There's not too much more to say about it. It's just kind of like all actually sad if you dig into it. I'm yeah, just course. Doing like kind of surface level, like this is a little social experiment. Maybe if reactions to this special come out that are interesting, I'll talk about that. But no, I'm over being
have you taped the
canceled
show?
Guy.
Have you taped the special?
Not yet. I'm planning on it in a couple months.
Okay. Yeah. And can you talk about that? Is that under wraps at the moment?
It's still like the deal hasn't gone through yet. So I want to, okay. Yeah. But I mean, it, by deal, I just mean somebody has agreed to film it and it'll probably end up on YouTube.
Yeah.
But maybe somebody will buy it. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Talk to me about Stamptown and your relationship with them and that beast. Because they produced your show.
Stamptown produced my show at Edinburgh. I saw them at their first New York show they did in summer of 2021. They asked me to be on it. My friend Marsha Belsky recommended me for them. And I just like, I thought it was just some show at a venue I perform at all the time, Union Hall in Brooklyn. I'm like, yeah, whatever. I don't care. Like, why are you emailing me? Like, it's just a heads up. This guy Zach's going to reach out. I'm like, I don't give a shit. Yeah, I'll do the gig. Who cares? And then I did the show and I was like, oh, this show's different. This is so much fun. And I told Zach, I'm like, hey, anytime you want me back in any capacity, I'm down. And thus it began a long and beautiful friendship.
Ah, that's lovely. That's good.
I guess
to hear.
I don't know. And a curse, you know. He had me do this thing where I live review the show.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
He just kind of it was a pitch by our friend Jeremy Elder, part of Business Casual sketch comedy group. And they like pitched me to be watching the show, and mm-hmm. as I'm watching it, I'm writing a review, and they check in on me every so often.
That's
and
a great idea.
It was and it worked really well. And people loved it. And then because people loved it, I had to keep doing it. And it's hard to keep doing it. To watch a 2.5 hour Stamptown show and try to be funny every single minute of it, be jotting jokes down.
Sure.
It's like a writing gig. It's like a writing job. You know,
presumably
like,
they paid you 10 times as much as anyone else on the year. Yeah.
Exactly.
That's hard. He actually, Zach, his previous question, other than whether you think he's funny or cool, he said... how your style translates. Talk about how your style translates to different crowds. For example, when he did his review a bit where he live reviewed the shows in LA, they were the PC woke police who legitimately didn't get it was a character, which is ridiculous. It couldn't be more clear to me that it's a persona. I think we've covered that a little bit, but I feel like we've covered that. Have we covered that? Are there different?
Sure. I mean, that was just an example of me trying to write my show for an audience that didn't get it in the span of an hour, over the course of an hour, on material I was unfamiliar with, you know, acts I had never seen before and stuff. So it's like, yeah, that was the problem there.
And tell me about your writing process. What does it look like? That's a great face, Martin. And do you mean to suggest that you have no writing process?
I just kind of speak from the heart. No. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it used to just be like I would take a premise that I had heard a lot and then try to take it in a direction that I hadn't heard before.
Okay.
And I wonder if that has just kind of stuck by. I mean, that's like a lot of like the Me Too stuff is just these yes. premises. I hear people yes, say them if legitimately.
If it's comedy about comedy, you just need to yeah. watch a load of bad comedy and go,
yeah.
great.
And it can
oh,
get...
that must hurt.
Oh, it hurts so bad.
I simultaneously thought, what an efficient system. Christ, I'm glad I don't have to do that.
yeah. Literally just see all these guys just get standing ovations and packed out theaters and me being like just in my shitty apartment just like, okay, all right, what did they say? yeah. I don't know. What's your writing process?
Oh, my God. I don't know. At the moment, my most recent show is about the climate crisis.
Yes, so yes. I loved it.
Thank you. My writing process for that was to curl up into a little ball and think of what was worrying me most today.
Sure.
And then find out a small amount about it. And then I would try to... I don't know if they were premises exactly, but I would try, for the first time, it's very different for me. I would try to go, okay, I specifically have a subject that I'm writing towards.
Mm.
And so I was trying to find out, what can I do? What can I offer? What could be useful for me to say and useful for people to hear? And I suppose I just ended up, by the end of it, I could look back and go, oh, the most efficient way of doing this would have been to find a thing that terrifies me. This is quite useful. I've not been asked this before. I'll be referring back to this episode when I write the next one. Find a thing that sort of terrifies me and think about the way I'm feeling about it and what's funny about that.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Rather than the stuff. I tried to write jokes about ocean acidification or, you know, you can choose any horrific climate fact. You know, there's something. I tried to write a bit I could never get away, which was about... The oceans are rising, the temperature of the oceans are now rising at a rate of, I mean, I can't remember the quote, but it's something like 4 Hiroshimas per second.
Whoa.
Or I don't even, but the point of the bit is, I can't put that in any kind of context. Like, is that too many Hiroshimas per second? Is that not nearly enough Hiroshimas per second? I like it. I'm glad it's making you laugh because I never managed to really get it away in a club because
interesting.
It's I was just fighting against so many, like, they don't want to hear about the climate.
Right.
And even if they did, I'd be telling myself they don't want to hear about the climate. I'd be magnifying any look of disinterest. I'd be going, oh, this proves it. Fuck, this is a stupid idea.
Yeah, totally.
I found it torturous. I found the process torturous.
I mean, I just like had no other choice. Like, I like committed to this thing. And I'm like, well, I'm just going to do it.
Yeah. That's nice. That's nice. I've made a commitment. I'm going to do it. That sounds mentally robust, Martin.
No.
No.
Because it would still make me sad. But I don't know. It is weird to go in front of a crowd that you know is like, they're not going to like this. They're not going to like what I have to offer. And I don't know if you see other comics go up and they're like, yeah, they're just talking about like dating. Like that seems like just like nice and fun for a date night. And then I'm going to come up with my shit. But you know, the people that like it.
Have you ever done, I have no idea of your comedy career. Let's find out a bit more about that. Do you have material which is nice material about dating?
No.
No.
No. I don't know how to do
that. I felt like you probably didn't. But, like, has there ever been like a safety set where you're like, I can do this stuff and that's, you know, it's not all registered sex offender mocking comics. Do you mean it's not all specifically mocking comics? Like the kind of the jokes about your ethnicity.
Yeah.
You know, like, those are very quick pullback reveal. You know, that's
simple. Yeah.
A safety set's the wrong word for it, but like non-thematic set.
I know what you mean, but I only have like 5 minutes of that. You know,
really?
I'm just like, it's what I have, but I'm just like, okay, I can pull these little ones out and cobble together like a safe 5 to 10 minutes. Depending on the crowd, because you know there's some, like, you know, I'm not like doing something so insane, like it's like, you know, Steve Martin was like being a character back in, you know, the 70s. It's like there's character comedy exists, but most of it's just so spicy. Yeah, I have to like pull out little pieces, but I'm like, I need to stand by it and want to put in my whole show. I don't have ones that I'm just like, oh, let me just entertain these people. As soon as I do that, I'm like, what am I doing this for? I can do any job in the entire world if I'm doing something I don't like. The whole point is I'm doing something I like and I stand behind.
Oh, so, that's good to hear. That's good to be reminded of. And I would like the listener, sorry to interrupt
oh, sure.
you.
No,
I would
no.
like the listener to just, I'm just going to, I'd like the listener to hear me pause and reflect on that.
Yeah.
Because I have not always done stuff throughout my whole career that I can completely, not that I can completely stand by, but I've done stuff where I've been like, I'm paying the rent today. You know, I'm paying, like, well, there are, you know, like, I mean, this came up with a podcast I did earlier on, but a long time ago, I used to do TV warm-up for a show that I didn't respect at all.
Ooh, what show
was
that?
And I had just bought, it was Loose Women, which I think is like The View. Oh, yeah, yeah, right? But I just bought a flat, and I desperately needed the money. And I think that it changed me. It made me worse.
Interesting.
And it not only, I don't know if it made me worse, but it did satisfy the urge to perform every day. I was doing a lot, but, you know, at the time I did it, I was doing it frequently.
Yeah.
And I would think to myself, well, I'll go out and do some open mics tonight. And then I didn't, because I'd done two shows of that. And I'd already done the dopamine roller coaster. And I went, you know what? I'm exhausted.
Sure.
And I remember thinking, I'm not pushing myself hard enough here. Fuck, I'm getting worse.
How long did you do that gig for?
A little while. I don't want to tell you. I'm not proud of how long I did it for.
No, but I mean...
I just bought a flat.
This
is 2008. The economy crashed the day I bought a flat.
I suddenly was
in negative equity. It was awful.
I mean, dude, like, that's also like a big part of it to me is, yeah, I'm also being pretentious when I say that, like, oh, I want to do something. It's like, yeah, people have like families and like rent to pay. Like, I don't mind, you know, everybody trying to make ends meet, you know.
Of course.
I'm honestly like, and that's why I like point a lot of my stuff at the millionaires.
Yeah.
Who, like, that's why I'm making fun of them, because I'm like, that's really who it's like, well, really, you're gonna do that? You're getting paid millions of dollars and you're gonna complain about, you can't say anything anymore?
Sure, yeah.
That's who I really blame. But yeah, me personally, I'm like, you know, as I said all that and you were like, let's pause and reflect on it, I was like, oh, because I also wanted to say, at the same time, I'm starting to think I should get a safety set together.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I really had that thought kind of recently. Like, well, yeah, well, let me have something. If they're hating what I have, is there some way I can pivot?
Could I craft a single other gear
to
which to change?
Yeah. And granted, it'll come from a place of anger. You'd be like, oh, you don't like that? Well, how about this?
So I don't know
what that would look like either, but I don't know.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
So this is Martin. He honestly is. He's got such a kind of Simpsons vibe. And I mean that in the best possible way. He's so sort of gentle and warm and disarming. But really, really, I mean, mind like a steel trap. If you haven't seen his stuff, if you haven't seen his set on Jimmy Kimmel, just grab that now and watch that set. It's so, so funny. And it gives you a sense of sort of the layers, the spheres within which he is working. Really, really fun chatting to him. In the second half, we're going to talk about his active choice of not having a social media strategy, as well as finding out, of course, whether or not Martin Urbano is happy. He continues his apology comeback tour with live dates coming up in New York and Austin in April. You can find out more and find out all about him at Linktree. That's linktree.ee/Martin Urbano. And follow him at Martin Urbano on Twitter or Martin Urbano Jr. Martin Urbano Jr., that is. On Instagram. So do look out for his live sets. Absolutely brilliant. And watch what he's up to on video. On video, you know, on YouTube, but in a video form. Quick plug for Mac. On the Saturday, the 4th of May, I will be performing not only Redacted, which by the time you hear this is almost certainly sold out, but you may as well try. We've got Nathaniel Metcalf, as well as Chloe Petz, and the fabulous Amy Gledhill. All of them are going to be being brilliant in Redacted, a special ComCom-flavoured kind of
sort of a piss about, really. That's at 4 p.m. No, it's not. It's at 2 p.m. on Saturday the 4th of May, the Saturday of Mac. At 8 p.m, however, I will be reprising Spoilers. And this is a show that is almost certainly not going to tour. So if you're at the festival and you want the chance to get to see it, then please come along to that. The links and all the rest of it are in the show notes. Now, let us return to Mr. Martin Urbana. So what is the next? What do the next 6 months look like? What are the where are you in your kind of creative cycle?
Well, I'm going on the road back in the States once I get back. I have quite a few gigs coming up through April, and the hope is to tape it in April. Mm-hmm. I've had talks about it. I need to follow up like this week, but I've just been focused on Soho. Mm-hmm. But I need to follow up. Hopefully tape it April, May at the latest. And if nobody wants to help me with it, I'm just going to set up a tripod, tape it, and put it out on YouTube because I'm done with it.
It'll do great on YouTube. Are you confident about that? Have you got much of a strategy for like your social media, or you no. Are you active?
I'm not good at it.
How often you're laughing as you respond in the negative to these questions.
I don't know. I don't know how to do it. I don't have a following. I mean, I have a modest, you know, amount of people who like me, which is nice. But yeah, I see other people who are really good at social media. I try a little, but certainly don't have like a successful following, a successful podcast, you know, clips that have been doing really well. I don't really have any of that. So that's my lean away from YouTube, is because I see the people who it does work well for are people who have followings that I think it'll pop off. So I don't know if it would work, but I'm down to just try it if that's what it comes down to. But hopefully this deal comes through and then something more happens, because I like the idea for this special specifically, for there to be some level of not prestige, but maybe prestige, but like something that makes it look a little bit more like other people signed off on this too.
Yes. Yeah,
if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure.
For this material specifically.
For this material, yes. You need the kind of the positioning, the framing of this has been thought through.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was why I came to Fringe also, you know, to like get these like reviews and this like prestige of coming and doing that.
I could see it being so big on YouTube. I don't know if that sounds like a backhanded compliment.
No,
you
I
could be
know.
Massive on YouTube, but no, I think that's a real thing, nice. Right?
It's the new, one of the biggest new avenues.
Not least because, not only because it's good quality, like it's really good quality. I love the show. I thought it was great.
Thanks, man.
But also because there is the scope for people to argue about it. And
sure.
Drive the algorithm. Fuck, man. You could do you yeah. have a TikTok?
I technically do. I had a friend who was running it for a while.
Okay.
And he got me some followers, and then I just he got too busy, and I never picked it up because I don't understand how it works. Okay. I'm a big fan of Anthony Jeselnik. Mm-hmm. And he talks about how like his fans, he like has been slowly trying to turn over his fan base.
Yeah, right.
Because he got a lot of people who he does not like or agree with or are laughing for the wrong reasons. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, let me try to think about that early on.
Right.
So even though it maybe doesn't seem like I have thought about it, I think about it a lot to try to make sure as much as I can to not have those fans and not develop that crazy like big fan base, which
you need
to my own detriment financially. But I think in the long run, it'll work out.
You need to strategically go viral by inspiring those arguments so that the comments mean you're discovered by the right people.
Yes.
And then intersperse them, like alternate them with videos where you clearly explain you're not welcome here.
Sure, yeah.
Here's a joke about maths.
Sure.
You won't like this at all.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're kind of playing with fire. I've seen lots of iterations, I think, lots of different versions of that phenomenon of like someone, there's an actor, works a lot in the UK, who was known for being very outspoken about anxiety, and then everyone would come up to them and tell them all about their anxiety crises and stuff, and eventually they were like, okay, enough, I don't want to be the spokesperson for
Whoa.
This.
Like, who was that?
Sophie Hayen.
Oh, interesting.
Hayen, I think.
Chris Gethard, you know, because I'm friends with him, and
I've toured
with him.
His suicide
his
material.
Career suicide special, suicide stuff. So he was like, it's just so heavy to just be there, and like people are like, this meant so much to me. Here's everything about my suicidal. It's like he had to like he says like if somebody's like being like a bit like too much, like if you can just like move them along the line politely, please, because it's heavy. That's like a lot to weigh on a person,
and it's you want to be respectful to it every time, but it's the 30th. This is the deepest. No, I have to talk to you about this.
Yeah.
I think that's what Sophie experienced.
Totally.
And I think there are other, like Daniel Kitson, famously in the UK, kind of, or non-famously, famously amongst exactly the right small people. But yeah, having exactly that problem with overhear. I think he overheard, he was using the bathroom before a gig, and he overheard two of the people who were there to see him and realized he didn't like them.
Whoa.
And, like, that was early, a long time ago. And sort of made a very specific decision to be as exclusive and hard to find as possible to weed out.
Wow.
Yeah. People who
That's really cool.
I mean, great problem to have.
Yeah.
Or is it? Great problem to have from the outside. I imagine when you're having that challenge, that is not so great.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to wrap up with some quick fire questions. What great idea did you try once and then never again?
Ooh. My first real closer outside of the Mad Libs bit was this one where I would pretend to, like, forget. I'd be like, I wrote this burger joke. And I'd pretend to forget the burger joke. And be like, oh, guys, honestly, I'm having, like, a hard time. And I would save it with that. My girlfriend broke up with me, so because I was, that joke. So I would kind of dig myself out of it, but be like, oh, but I'm just so flustered. If somebody could read my jokes for me, so I gave a paper to an audience member and gave them the microphone, and then I would act them out on stage. And then as they were doing it, I, a couple jokes here and there, and then as they were starting to get the hang of it, I would give them one that was like, and here's my impression of Matthew McConaughey if he were a GPS. Turn right, turn right, turn right. And then no matter what they did, it's like a little trap. Because even if they tried to do it, then I can just like pretend to like break or whatever and then turn around and be like, and then say, sigh, guys, I don't know what I'm doing with my life. I told everybody I was going to make it as a stand-up comedian, but I'm not good at it. I have a terrible Matthew McConaughey impression. I should just give up. And then be like, oh, wait, I remember my burger joke. And then it was just like the worst joke of all time. And so like that bit, and even in retelling, I'm like, oh, yeah, there's so many good beats there.
There's something there, right? That's some beats, yeah.
But I did it one time. I was filming a thing in Las Vegas for Will Smith. Pre-slap Will Smith was doing a comedy showcase. And they were like, okay, you're going to get 10 minutes. We're only going to use 5 of them, but you get 10 minutes. So I was like, okay. So I had my 5 minutes. I'm like, this is like a good like Vegas-y like act. Like this will probably be what they use. But since I have this other 5 minutes, let me try that bit and just have it on tape. And then I can use that for something else. Just ask for the footage. The people were so concerned that I was having a mental breakdown on stage. And the bit just went so bad. Finally, by the end of it, where I remember my burger joke, people are like, okay.
Oh, God.
And I was like, that was mortifying. And then as I got off stage, Will Smith comes up to like me and the other comics who are on the show. I was like, hey, good job, everybody. You know, some of you had me concerned up there. He like looked at me. I'm like, okay, I'm never doing that bit ever again. That was my final time doing that bit. And I just kind of broke it apart for scraps. And I have a different one where an audience member reads my jokes. But yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Mortifying. I think I've heard a strategy when people say, do 10, but we're only going to use 5. People just do 5 so that they have to use the 5 that they've done.
Sure.
But maybe you don't want to play that game with Will Smith.
yeah.
But good for you. Good for you for backing yourself and trying an experimental bit at a pressure gig. It's a mate for a rich and varied life.
I always thought that bit was going to be like on Conan or something. Like that was the one that was going to break me. And then it just like, I could never get it on television. So I was like, this is like my sneaky in to get it on TV.
Yeah.
And it just, blew up right in my face. So
what's funny about you?
Huh? Interesting. You know, I never thought I was very funny. I think I'm very clever. Despite what the Guardian may say about me, I think I'm decently clever, and that's my in.
That's a good answer. You're very good at. I noticed this among American comics. You're good at ending a sentence in a way that says no further questions.
I don't know.
Yeah. So is your answer to that you don't think there's anything funny about you? Like, what? Come on. You must, like, you know you're funny. You're clever as well.
Sure.
But like,
okay.
What is the funny? What is the funniness of you? Where does it? What's the root of the bit that you connect with the audience? It's not simply the cleverness.
Okay, that's
the show would be awful if it was just clever. I mean, I'd still like it, but you know, but yeah. What I love about it is it's so kind of like you are like the sunrise. You smile, and it's like sunshine fills the room.
Oh, that's really nice.
It's lovely.
I like being silly. Being silly is a lot of fun. I don't know. It's what's funny about me? That's a deep question. But I've thought about it more and more, and I think when I was younger, I was like a little bit more adamant that it was only because I'm clever. And as time has gone on, I realized how much of my sense of humor has been informed by the silly people around me, even though I didn't really always connect with their styles of humor, like back home. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a reason that I was like wanting to go to. I'm from a small town where I was like, I like stand-up comedy. They're like George Lopez, like Gabriel Iglesias. And I'm like, no, not them exactly. These other people. And people are like, never heard of them. Never will.
Yeah.
Dimitri who? You know? Like, okay. And so I was like always wanting to go and find that. But the more I reflect on it, it's like, oh yeah, my Thea was so funny. Is so funny. And my cousins and like just like their way of joking and their silliness and their jovialness, even though it didn't really you know, it wasn't always on the same topics. Like sometimes they'll send like memes into the family group chat and be like, I don't really like that, but you know, hey, good on you. I really realize how much my delivery and like how to be silly is inspired by them. That's something I've only learned kind of recently. Yeah.
Why did you learn that recently?
Because I think I was asked this question. No. like in the past year, I don't know. You just start thinking about it. And I think also I started dating somebody new. And then I think when you start dating somebody new, you kind of like re-exploring like what you're discovering their sense of humor as they're discovering yours. So there's something there of like, oh, that the way I said that is just like how my cousin would or whatever, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder. I think that's a part of it.
That's nice.
Yeah. What about you?
That's nice.
What's your answer?
Oh, I don't have one.
Hey, come on.
I don't have to have one. It's my show.
Oh, damn.
No, I answer this question all the time in depth and the audience would be bored. No, I don't know. What's funny about me? I don't know. I don't think I have been asked that before. Really, in many ways, the show is a cry for help. If only someone would ask me these questions. I think that, I don't know. I when I'm feeling negative, I think I'm just getting away with it on charisma.
Ooh.
I think my negative self-image is that, oh, it's not that I'm funny, I'm just charismatic, and that's kind of devious somehow, rather than being
interesting.
A positive thing. But that's a very negative self-belief. Yeah. If I were to back myself, I'm clearly funny. Why am I funny? I think I'm empathic. I think I can sometimes feel with them, and so I can feel with them what would be funny now. Maybe
that's nice. I like
is
that.
Is it?
I like it.
Yeah, I mean, because I really like silly stuff. My whole thing, and God knows we don't need more comedians talking about ADHD. But having said that, I had a diagnosis earlier this year, and I had an exciting month of going fucking hell, wow, this changes everything. Then I forgot for 6 months. I said last year. I mean, then I forgot, and then I started to kind of really process it in a much more deep kind of useful. Oh God, I kind of can be a bit kinder to myself now, in a meaningful way that wasn't me running around telling everyone, you know. And I think part of that really helped me. I feel like I've always struggled to be relatable to an audience. I always do stuff about, I just feel like a lot of times I've done stuff like, you know when? And people have been like, we don't know when, you know? And I wonder how much that's held me back, because I and also I'm probably quite sort of self-involved, and I'm more interested in saying, oh, this thing happened to me, to which a reasonable answer is, who cares? You know? So I think that there will definitely be some kind of intersection between the funniness I am and the funniness I have. I'm sort of whiffling now. I tell you what it is. A way I've described it to a friend actually in the past is, I think, for better or worse, I am sometimes able to react very, very quickly. The way I think of it is, like, you know those guys that do Wing Chun?
Wing Chun? Yeah.
You know, so if someone strikes you, this is the sum total of my knowledge about Wing Chun. Someone goes to strike you and they take the force out of the punch by knocking it very quickly that way and then that way and then that way and then they hit you, right?
Got it.
So they do this thing which is like, or if you imagine a Jackie Chan movie when he's training on one of those dolls that like
it's
a wooden thing
out
with the four sticks.
Yeah.
And he goes, dunk, dunk, dunk. Yeah. That's how I visualize it. I think sometimes conversationally, someone will say a thing and I'll just go, dung, like that. And it, you know what I mean? But I won't, like, I don't, if I thought about it, it wouldn't work. Maybe that's why I don't do writing jobs. If I sit down and writing, I become self-conscious and I'm aware that I'm writing.
Interesting.
Whereas I think, just if a thing flies across my consciousness and I go, bah! Like that, then it gets funny. And I'm like, God, why can't I do that? Do that again. Do that again. So my whole artistic career has been putting myself in positions in which that has the space to happen.
That's
and
great.
Then I guess a lot of my work, for better or worse, has been me recreating moments where I once went like that. Yeah.
Stuart, you should do reaction videos.
What should I react to?
To stand up.
I've had that idea.
People do that. People do that.
Do
yeah.
they? I've had that idea that I mean, the thing is, I couldn't because my position as the interviewer here.
Be mean to your friends. It's like you can't actually.
Maybe
do that.
I should only do it to people I know.
That's fun.
That's fun.
That's
I should
fun.
Get comics I know and I've got a good relationship with them.
Yeah.
And I should react to their stand-up. Is yeah. that the worst idea? Is that the best? That might be a good idea.
It depends. It depends.
Have you seen Josh Nassar? Do you know him?
No.
I'm going to get him on the podcast. I ran into him at the store in LA. I was doing a tiny, like, I was doing a warm-up before I did my Conan set. And I ran into him. We just got chatting. And since then, he's become this monster on YouTube and TikTok and everything, because what he does, you may have seen them, they're crazy viral. He just very cheerily does little kind of almost dad jokes where he'll pull up next to someone in his car, like pull up next to some cops, and he'll be like, hey, I want to report a crime. And they'll go, what? And he goes, she's stolen my heart. And like, you know what I mean? Whatever, just like little flirty yeah. things. And they are joyful. They're yeah. a joy to watch.
I have seen these, yes.
Yeah, right? Yeah, and yeah. so this guy's a comic. He's a good comic, but he's just found this thing and he just does little fun. He is the world's sunniest kind of like, they're just blooming with positivity in a quite horrible world, you know. So trying, I don't know why I mentioned that, because he's cracked a thing. I'm like, maybe I'll do reaction videos to yeah. the people I know.
If you react really quickly and well, react to stuff.
I think my reaction things are me going, just two blinks.
yeah. You're just dead to stand up at this point. I mean, it's like we're all that way.
That's
you know?
The danger.
Yeah.
I do reaction videos where I laugh before the punchline. Yeah, comedian reacts. Oh, that's good. Yeah, I thought so. Yeah,
I see where you're going. Yeah, yeah. That's good.
Right, let's wrap up. Let's do one more.
Yeah.
Martin, are you happy?
Yes. Yes, I am. Yeah. Anything else?
I always like to ask that question and be quiet for ages, because sometimes people talk themselves into a more specific position.
Oh, sure. Things have just been going well, you know, and even when I get frustrated or times have been tough or get tough, I'm feeling pretty good about things right now. I'm very lucky. Count my blessings. Love the people in my life. Been having cool opportunities like this. You know, it's been nice very recently to have so much stuff kind of come full circle. Like, I listened to Comedians Comedian podcast years ago when Bo was on it, when he did Fringe.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
That's a long time
ago. And that's when I first became obsessed with the Fringe, more or less. Like, yeah, that's, it's to now come back and to meet people, meet you, you know, got to meet David O'Doherty very briefly the other, when at Fringe, you know, it's just like, oh, wow. Like, the people that I was like, wow, there's comedy that I'm interested in and I like that's so far away, and one day I'll get there. And to be there now, it's so lucky. Now, if I look at my bank account, I have reasons to start stressing out. Maybe I need that safety set we talked about. But overall, I'm just really happy with the way everything's gone down.
You're welcome and sorry.
Sure, yeah.
That was Martin. 20 more minutes with him. If you're in the Insiders Club, you can join up at patreon.com/comcompod. Or if you also test this, if you like, but I'm fairly certain comedianscomedian.com/insiders, which I've said over 1,000 times now,
We'll also direct you to that if I've done the internet jiggery pokery well enough. So if you're in New York or if you're in Austin in April, find out more. You can go and see Martin live. Go to linktree.com/Martin Urbano. You can follow him on Twitter at Martin Urbano or Instagram at Martin Urbano Jr. And he has done lots with Stamptown as well. You should follow Stamptown. I don't have that in front of me, but you should follow Zach Zucker and indeed Stamptown, because if you like the cut of Martin's jib, then you will probably like all of the people who are connected with Stamptown, because it is already a powerhouse of sort of young, exciting comic talent. I've got to stop pointing out how young they are, but they are young. They were a joy to perform with at South by Southwest in Austin only the other week. Remember, if you're on the Saturday at Mac, come to Redacted if you've already got a ticket or can snaffle up the last one or two at 2 p.m. on the Saturday. Spoilers is on at 8 p.m. in the school venue, Isgol, and a lot of fun it will be too. That show is now raring to go and I can't wait for you to see it. All your links in the show notes. And a reminder, of course, more broadly about Patreon, where now you can watch the episodes. You get full video episodes. The extra content is now in video as well as audio. There's no adverts on any of it, and you get exclusive guest announcements. The Redacted show mostly sold out to the insiders, so be there for things like that. And I've just recorded, I will do a tiny, tiny little post-amble at you today, because I've just recorded a solid hour Q&A, which is a sort of a Q&A, but it's largely a long post-amble. And I answered some questions from the Insiders Club, and I also covered some tips that I've gleaned from my ADHD executive coach, yes, but actual really useful, incredibly useful tips about processing information and managing stuff, as well as me fascinatingly recounting a meme about coping with anxiety, which I haven't tried yet, but I'm certain it'll work. So all of that, go to patreon.com/comcompod. You can get into all of that all on the new RSS feed. Thanks to Martin. Thank you to producer Callum for sorting this all out. Thanks to Rob Smouten for the music and Susie Lewis for the logs. And, of course, a huge thank you to our insider producers, Glenn Tickle, Sam Allen, Jay Lucas, Gary McClellan, Dave McCarroll, Miles Walsh, Nick Waite, Andres Purdy, Caroline Schmidt, Jonathan Stewart, Richard Lucas, Paul Swaddle, James Burry, Ashley Stewart and Mike Sheldon. Of course, a big thank you, as ever, to our insider executive producer, Neil Steeler's Wheel Peters. And can we please get some more women in the insider's producers gang? Because that is a huge list of men. With, I think, two women in it, max. I'll post-amble at you in just a second, but for now, that is that. Coming up soon. Oh, my God. Who have we got coming up? I can't even remember. Hang on, I've got a list. Coming still to come, Mike Wozniak, Julia Masley, Finn Taylor versus the Internet, Di Henwood, Tanya Lee Davis, Lynn Coplitz, Brian Simpson and Jabuki Young White. All of those are in the can. Jeffrey Asmus will be with us before too long. We're just sorting a date out where he doesn't have to immediately pull out at the last minute because he's too successful. But that will come to you before too long. Bye for now. I think on my list of things to talk to you about, I've used up all my things. I was quite organised about my life. Did I tell you I saw Ed Gamble? I saw Ed's show. It was so lovely to hang out with Gamble and see him doing stuff at the Hippodrome. I took my friend Ond, and Ond was, it was very funny. We sat there in the kind of the middle seats in this, well, I don't know what it is, 1800 seater venue. And he was like, oh, I've never seen stand-up like this before in this sort of environment. Because it is such a different beast, isn't it? It's one of the skills you have to learn as a comic. But the vast majority of the hour-long shows or hour or more shows I've seen have been very deliberately in little black boxes and studio theatres and dives and underground cellars and what have you, as opposed to the above-ground cellars, which are way less popular. The Hippodrome is just this vast thing, and there was Ed with his enormous banners behind him, like, you know, an actual set. Yeah, it's great. Really fun show. Really fun show. And the most fun moments, I think, are when my favourite moments were when he had lots of little silly, vulnerable, honest, little blurty moments, which I loved in amongst all of the barnstorming, big, chunky stuff that is the crowd-pleasing stuff. There was also lots and lots of texture in there, which I enjoyed very much. Do I want to tell you about this? No. Instead, I might just wax lyrical about the simple joy of building a wall. This is a recurrent theme in my life. I think to myself, I could jack it all in and become a bricklayer. And I couldn't. I'd be an absolutely shocking bricklayer. But I really do enjoy doing sort of physical fixing of things. here's a thing. Can anyone teach me to sew? Because it drives me up the wall that I can do basic DIY, but I can't do basic clothes DIY. What's a good... Has anyone to... Here we go. Rather than asking someone to come around my house and teach me to sew, is there any sense, is there any point in me buying or borrowing a proper sewing machine and getting lessons from a human? I don't think... It's too fiddly. I don't think I can do it from a YouTube video, and I certainly can't read any instructions. But has anyone had experience... This is it. Has anyone had experience of being taught to sew by a human being in a kind of grown-up learning way, whereby they just sort of turn up and you have a nice cup of tea and they go, here's how you fix your jeans. Because my bloody jeans pocket, this is the content you come here for. It's the same problem every fucking time. It's the left-hand jeans pocket where my phone rubs against. All the advice you'll get online and from humans to your actual face will be stop keeping your phone in your pocket. But that is as insane to me as wearing shoes in which you are unable to run for a bus. Come on, you have basic responsibilities yourself. You have to be able to carry your phone in your pockets in case you need it for an emergency. But I end up putting my phone in my pocket, and as a result, all my pairs of jeans, it's not sustainable. It genuinely, in a climate way, I want to be able to fix my fucking clothes when they rip. Because I'm ending up getting through, you know, it's not, I'm not throwing them away, but now I've got like 9 pairs of trousers for doing jobs in, you know, wall building trousers. And if I just extended the wall building skills to be able to use a sewing machine, I'm pretty sure, I mean, in my mind, what I'm imagining is you get the jeans that are ripped and you just sort of push them back and forth next to a sewing machine and then they're magically fixed. There may be more to it than that. But my point is it a lost cause or is it worth learning? So the question is not can you sew, but the question is have you been taught as an adult to sew in one or two brief lessons in such a way that you've activated that learning and made use of it? Imagine being able to let your own trousers out if you're in, for example, your mid to late 40s and you suddenly realise you didn't fit the trousers you do corporates in anymore. For instance, just for instance, bye! I now need to take my boy climbing. So this will be truncated, which is, I think, in everyone's best interests. But get in touch. Also, new system. When you contact me via email or on Twitter about things I've said on the podcast in the postamble, where I've said, hey, get in touch and do this, without fail, every single time, I don't know what any of you are talking about. So can we have a system? Can we have... What about the... Can we choose an emoji, a specific emoji, like the upside down guy or the melty guy? I love that one. Such that you could use, just send me an emoji. You could use it as a code to say, this is a reference to a thing you said on the podcast in the postamble, because I never know what anyone's talking about. And it would benefit me enormously if there was a little code. I could just go, oh, this must be related to a thing I said that I can't remember. And then we'll work out what happens next further down the line. But for now, suggest, please, the most appropriate emoji for that. What about the one that's looking through his fingers or the one peeping out from in a cloud? I don't know. The cloud of memory. But I don't know if it's a popular enough emoji that everyone has access to it. Or is that ridiculous? Do we all have the same emojis? Do we all have the same emojis? Or is it, am I thinking like WhatsApp have got different emojis to Facebook? Is that mad? They're both owned by the same company, aren't they? I imagine they're the same. Imagine that. You know, I think a good way to end these would just be if music gradually swelled up and fucking got rid of me. I must take the boy climbing. Goodbye. I hope you had a lovely Easter, or are about to have, or are during having a lovely Easter, or are having an Easter in one of the many years of Easters preceding this until the food wars of 2040. You heard it here first. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.